evening. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. It's tape 411, side one, October 19th, 1979. Last week, I briefly mentioned the near death, the shooting in Miami of Antonio Vassiana. I didn't get space enough to put on the printed sheet that went with your tapes. The date of the shooting, he was in a passing car, a car that went by him, fired at him. That article, as I mentioned before, was a one-inch column in the New York Times. On page 43, they did admit or say that he founded the Alpha 66, that notorious anti-Castro Cuban exile group in the Miami area that then spread on to New Orleans and the Southwest and Texas, and they've worked in California, and even the Alpha 66 is here working with Fort Ord and out in Salinas. They're doing their training right now. Well, the one-inch column on page 43 hardly gave much information. I want to give you two more references about him. Evidently, he survived this ambush. But the new House Select Committee on Assassinations has their final report out now. It's issued. And this is the summary, not the testimony. It's similar to the Warren Report. It's the report that came out 13 years later on the assassination of John Kennedy and Reverend Martin Luther King. But on page 160 and 161, and in the section 162 and 163, there's a discussion of Antonio Vassiana Blanche, B-L-A-N-C-H, and it tells about his long association with the Central Intelligence Agency, and in fact, he was part of an assassination team in Chile in 1971, and I've referred to those assassination teams that Jack Anderson briefly touched upon and the role they had in the Kennedy assassination, going back to that book, Treason for My Daily Bread, and Colonia Dignidad, the assassination centers down there in Chile. He was involved with an assassination attempt they were going to do on Fidel Castro in Chile in 71, but he does work with the Chilean assassination teams. The House Select Committee describes Vesciano's testimony. He gave a lot of testimony, which I mentioned last week, on Lee Harvey Oswald, but the important thing was that he testified to the House Select Committee that he had been contacted by a CIA man who knew about his work in Mexico City, and they offered him a large sum of money if he would say that he and his wife had met Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City, and that he wanted a relative to testify to that effect, and that he wasn't able to do so. But the important thing is that the Central Intelligence Agency wanted to set up Lee Harvey Oswald as a patsy, and they had a person impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico. And this man worked with Lee Harvey Oswald in Miami and in the New Orleans area in the CIA as a CIA agent, but they were setting up a trail of communist Oswald so when the assassination came down, they could blame the communists for killing John Kennedy, which in fact they did. Another reference to this person is in the continuing inquiry. That's the newsletter that Penn Jones gets out every month from Texas, from Midlothian, Texas. And this is a newspaper article about Mr. Vesciano and the anti-Castro Cubans and his work with Claire Luce and the doubles of Lee Harvey Oswald. This article is in Volume 3, Number 11 of Penn Jones' newsletter. And the person that they were talking about in this newsletter and in the final assassination report on the life of John Kennedy is the man that was shot at, and there was an attempted murder. And of course, we know how many, many of the witnesses to the House Select Committee this year, the past year, and the Senate Church Committee, and of course, before the Warren Commission, witnesses that were called to testify and witnesses that should have been called to testify were killed. So I imagine that he's gotten the message now and won't talk any more about Lee Harvey Oswald being in the CIA. There's a new book coming out about Elvis Presley, written by members of his family. And in this book, it's called Elvis, We Love You Tender. In the book, it says that Elvis first began to get his drug overdosing when he was in the Army in 1959. And the military men began to give him the amphetamines and narcotics that turned him into the drug addict that he became, and it eventually just killed him. The King of Rock was dead at an early age. The important thing about Elvis in the year 1959 of getting at him and putting him in the army and sending him to Germany was that he was a threat. His sounds and his motions were a threat to the white WASP class, the military, the South, where he lived, and they realized that his personality could be contagious and that he could become a leader. And the selected leaders, the people you can scream at and yell at, are like Frank Sinatra, who was always with members of organized crime. Elvis was independent, and the independent people in this system really don't make it. And the superstars are linked to organized crime or mafia. That's the way that Hollywood was taken over when it began as a legitimate place to make movies in the early days. The geniuses and the really great people were kicked out, and the thugs moved in, and that's why there's been such mediocre entertainment for so many years. Elvis had a good voice. The army was the place where he began to be drugged. Then he met his wife, future wife, Priscilla, at that German base, American base in Germany, and she came back with him. Her father was in the military, and then when he returned, he was totally drugged. And even though he became very successful, they kept him at making the kind of movies he wanted to make and could make, and he died young. He was just drugged off and was assured an early death. Another singer who died just a few weeks ago was Jimmy McCulloch, 26 years old, who worked with Paul McCartney in The Wings, a group called The Wings. He was found dead in his London hotel room, and as of this date, there's been no account of how he died. But many of you know I keep track of the various musicians and what's happened to them as part of a pattern, because as an art form, jazz and then the rock music, the folk and folk rock, became an art form that was able to mobilize people at a time when the young people were turning against the country, turning against the war, turning against the materialism of this country, and the whole goal was to get them back into purchasing and not dropping out of the system, but they become a part of it and not fracture out. And by lopping off the musicians who were political, it was effective to break the spirit of the movement as it was developing. Right now, there are some musicians who can draw large crowds in New York and so forth out here for anti-nuclear protests. But it was really mushrooming into a large thing in 1969 at the time of Woodstock. And that's why the government got into the Altamont concert with the Rolling Stones to break up that large mass movement of people who were out on the streets. It could be similar to the millions that followed Mahatma Gandhi as he led the British to the ocean and they were kicked out. This counterculture never really had a chance to develop. I mentioned several weeks ago in September, the Tribal Stomp concert that was here in Monterey. The first American appearance there was a group called The Clash, described as the most political anti-oppressive group representing the musical mainstream today. They're on the border of punk rock, but they're very, very political. And after the concert of The Clash, that was Saturday afternoon, I told you a woman that jumped off a bridge just about one block away from the music arena where the concert was over, just taking place. And at the concert, I told you people were handing out acid, asking us if they wanted to buy it, if you wanted to have it. And of course, the newspaper articles associated, again, the Tribal Stomp, the musicians, with death, because the death took place and this woman had jumped off, to show how crazy the young people are. They could be political on the stage, but look how crazy they are. Well, after the stories and all the splash was made about putting down again the musicians and the concert or the attempt to get together, it turned out that the woman did not jump off the bridge because of acid, but now it turns out that a man held her over the bridge by her ankles and dropped her, and she was killed. The trial for that is going to take place here in Monterey County, and I'm going to go to that trial. I don't want to take time off from my writing, but once in a while I do go down to the courthouse and see what's going on here, and I want to see if I can pick up any evidence of mind control or zombie in the person that held her over the bridge and dropped her. I don't know if that'll come out in the trial, but the trial is going to take place here in Monterey County November 13th. So I think I'll attend that trial and see what I can pick up from this, because it was the same cause and effect that the media carried. You may not be getting it northwest around the country, but here it was very centralized. Have a concert, sing about the establishment, kill yourself. They're following the same kind of phenomena that took place in the past to associate the music with death. There's another new book coming out by Robert Slatzer. It's called The Murder of Marilyn Monroe. It should be out in 1980. I met Robert Slatzer when I was in Los Angeles at Terry Moore's place. He told me his experiences with Marilyn. He had been married to her shortly. And Robert is absolutely convinced that Marilyn Monroe was murdered. And there's a long article in the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Examiner on the reasons why she was murdered. But we'll go into them when the book comes out. There's a book on show business murders and a series of different people who have died, some murdered, some alleged suicide. But a few people now are getting in their heads the fact that a disproportionate number of people have died young, and they haven't made the connecting links of the politics of the era, because that's hard to do, and there aren't very many people I know who are capable of doing it or even see the world that way yet. There's a new book out called Those Who Died Young by Marion Sinclair, and I bought the book this week and began to check off which people out of the categories I had evidence or reason to believe were murdered, and there's about 40 people that they write about in this book. But among them, I marked off the ones that I felt had been murdered, and there was Marilyn Monroe, Montgomery Clift, James Dean, Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, Jim Reeves, Otis Redding, Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Duane Allman, Mama Cass, Graham Parsons, Mark Bolan, Keith Moon, Bruce Lee, Che Guevara, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Eva Perón, and Martin Luther King. Now, that's an interesting combination. I did mentioned to some of you after I saw the play Evita and began to read more about Evita Perón's life, you understand why she died at age 33. And all of these people had the common enemy. They had something in common, was an untimely death, a suspicious death under strange circumstances, meeting with people who were similar in their hatred of them, and the goals for murdering these people all fell into the same basket. And I keep promising that tape or two or three tapes on the musicians. It will be coming. But there is this book now that does list all these musicians and John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Che Guevara, and Martin Luther King with the actors and musicians. And I think that's interesting. There's about eight persons in the book that I don't even know. Paul Kossoff, Sam Cooke, Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran. I'd have to study their lives and see what there was about their lives and where they were politically at the time they died. But this is the first book that I've seen that has the political figures like Martin Luther King and the Kennedys and Che Guevara in with the actors and the musicians that I already have done some research on. I once asked Terry Moore when I was going over with her the story of her life in Hollywood. She was a starlet who met Howard Hughes when she was young and made movies and worked during the war overseas for the USO and for organizations. She was a cover girl on Life magazine and still very attractive woman. And when she tells the story of her life, she would tell me about, well, I was friendly with this one, you know, and she'd tell me stories about Elizabeth Taylor and Mike Todd. Then Mike Todd's airplane was in a plane crash. And she was friendly with this one. And then she said, well, then he died very young. She was close. Jimmy Dean was in the home when they were just like kids together, just when their careers were coming up. And then Dean died. And then she would tell me about another one, and that one died, and another one. And all of a sudden, there were about 12 people around her, all budding careers, all died very young. And I said, well, this is a moving obituary. And the common denominator always was one constant factor through the whole thing that touched all of these people's lives. And that same person and organization was the common denominator behind John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, and the other political assassinations in this country. So this book coming out at this time is an interesting book, and you should read it. Another article making some connections, not saying the reasons why, but beginning to add them up, is an article that was in the Washington Post on airplane accidents, September the 23rd. The article's called Private Planes, the Heavy Toll, but it doesn't go into public planes such as United Airlines that had Dorothy Hunt, or the plane that went down over the Canary Islands and or playing with the writers at the writers' convention that was going to Los Angeles, or the San Diego, the PSA plane that the Lieutenant Governor Merv Dimerly was supposed to be on. Those were commercial planes. But this is an article on the heavy toll of private planes, and it lists politicians such as Representative Clem Miller from California, Hale Boggs, Jerry Pattis, Representative Jerry Pattis, Representative Jerry Litton from Missouri, Richard Obershane from Virginia, the nominee that lost when his plane crashed, John Warner, went into the Senate. A fellow recently surfaced who said that he was responsible for the airplane crash of one of these members of the House, Representative Jerry Litton. How many of these were set up? Then there's athletics, and there's a list of athletes who were in questionable crashes, and one of them that wasn't on the list that I felt was a political murder was Roberto Clemente, the Puerto Rican who was going over to help the earthquake victims in Nicaragua. And it has a list of athletics. Then the entertainment. Will Rogers and Wiley Post. Well, I didn't know until I began to delve into the Howard Hughes story that Howard Hughes was competing with Wiley Post for the world's airplane world's records in flying. And Will Rogers was making fun of the politicians. And they have Mike Todd on the list, and Buddy Holly, and Otis Redding, and Jim Reeves. Some of them are in that book. And Audie Murphy, and that's another common denominator. That was one of those persons that fell into that category of those 12 dead that Terry and I talked about. And it has the rock group The Chase and Leonard Skinner. Of course, that was very political group. And Jim Croce wasn't on that list, but that's one of that I have on the list. I have many, many entertainment people. But then this article has political people like Mr. and Mrs. George Skakel, the parents of Ethel Kennedy, Mrs. Angier Biddle Duke, the wife of the diplomat in New York. Carol Tyler is listed under others, and it says secretary to former Lyndon Johnson aide Bobby Baker, who died in Ocean City, Maryland in 1965, but she was also the roommate of Mary Jo Kopechne, who later was to die after that cookout with Ted Kennedy and the various political aides at Chappaquiddick. They list George Skakel, Jr., the brother of Ethel Kennedy, Walter Reuther, who died in a plane crash, but then they don't go into Yablonsky, whose family was purposely blown up, and Tony Boyle, the head of the United Mine Workers, was again convicted, had another trial, and was convicted last week for that conspiracy, and of course the sudden death out here in Carmel of Saul Alinsky, 6 months after, or 3 months after, a very political article in Playboy, which I want to do with you on a tape, and Natalie Sinatra in 1977. The Sinatra family was used before the kidnapping of his son as a diversionary from the Kennedy assassination. That's a long, complicated story, but they have other plane crashes. Mrs. Ted Stevens, the wife of the senator in Alaska, Alexander Guterma, the financier from New York, and at the height of Watergate hearings, the Senate investigating Watergate, most of the men on the Senate, there was something, payoffs going. Senator Talmadge, that's when his pockets began to get filled with those dollar bills, and there's Mr. Guernsey down in Florida, and then they linked Montoya, who died later, to organized crime out in the Southwest. There was something on everybody except Lowell Weicker, and I believe it was at the time of those hearings that Lowell Weicker's sister or brother, I'd have to look it up, was killed in a plane crash with nieces and nephews, families of political figures. So this article on the toll of private plane crashes breaks into politics, athletics, entertainment, and others, and almost everyone on that list has a political reason or a political common denominator with their early demise also. The controversy going on in Memphis, Tennessee about the cause of death of Elvis Presley, and his autopsy papers have been taken to a vault, and they've been locked in a bank vault so they can't be stolen or destroyed, and there's a trial going on. ABC has asked for them, the TV station, because, as I mentioned once before on a tape, the Tennessee Shelby County medical examiner, Jerry Francisco, said that Elvis Presley died of a heart attack, and there's a lawsuit saying that he was deliberately drugged, that he was given drugs. Now, that Tennessee area is a controversial one. We talked about Francisco being the one responsible for the autopsy on Martin Luther King, and they're not looking for another gunman coming from another direction where the bullets could have, the one single bullet could have felled Martin Luther King. But last week there was more, several weeks ago rather, there was more controversy with Dr. Francisco, and there was a murder of a young person, 9-year-old person, who was murdered in Nashville, and they're asking to now exhume that body on the basis of the qualifications of Dr. Francisco and his opinion on the murder of this particular little girl. Also, the prison officials there are under investigation. They had a man hired who was supposed to be a doctor and wasn't a doctor at all, working in Memphis, Tennessee, and working, I guess, with Dr. Francisco. He went by the name of George Allen, and he was in the prison in Nashville for 13 months. He worked under the State Department of Corrections and posed as a physician. He got $36,000 a year, and he was the chief medical examiner at the prison. So the so-called George Allen, this doctor, was working at this prison and was no medical doctor in any way, shape, or form. And it was at the prison in St. Louis, Missouri, where the doctor, according to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, was involved in drugs and drug dealings with James Earl Ray, and Ray managed, in quotes, to escape. But he had assistance in escaping, and it had something to do with a doctor and drugs. So here in Nashville, Tennessee, where Ray once did, in fact, escape, and I did some tapes on that phony escape, and he was only brought back because of the clamor. You have a man as the chief medical examiner. He went by an alias of Dr. Jesse Fairchild Adams, and he had been impersonating a particular doctor, Dr. Adams, who was a Navy surgeon living in the state of Washington. And he was hired August 7, 1978, during the administration of former Governor Ray Blanton. Ray Blanton was so irresponsible that he was charged with giving, selling prison clemency during his administration. People could get out of prison by buying off the governor and his aides. Incidentally, all those charges are dropped. Four men charged with selling prison clemency in Nashville, Tennessee. Just recently, those charges were dropped. But here's this man, George E. Allen, who was posing as a doctor, working in this particular prison and took the name of other people and had to be working as the chief medical examiner of the prison in Nashville, Tennessee. He would be working with Dr. Francisco and the governor of the state, and all of them are corrupt, and they're involved in the Elvis Presley killing and the cover-up. They're involved in the Martin Luther King killing cover-up. I shouldn't say in the killing, but they're certainly involved in the cover-up, and they're involved with letting people out of prison who belong in, and also with letting a man in there and pose as a doctor who wasn't a doctor at all. Many of you know that I'm particularly interested in the subject of doubles, the phenomena of duplicating and impersonating one person in order for another to be the patsy or the fall guy, or for a particular individual to escape. There's a new book out, and you may have seen the author. His name is Hugh Thomas. He's been on television and shows recently, talk shows. He's written a book called The Murder of Rudolf Hess, and he claims that the man in Spandau Prison really isn't Hess at all, and that there's been a double there all along. I think the psychological reason of keeping one man in prison was to let people think that justice was served after World War II, and also to make the Russians feel secure that the Allies had kept in prison a man who had helped go to England to try to mobilize them to work with Germany against the Soviet Union. The book is called The Murder of Hess. This man claims that actually Hess was shot down by Adolf Hitler in an airplane, but they duplicated another person and let him serve the time in prison, that he's been an imposter since 1941, that he is masqueraded, that Hitler didn't say that he killed Hess, but they've had this imposter. And that this particular doctor had gone into the prison and was suspicious because there were no chest wounds in Hess, where there were wounds in his chest and lungs before. And he didn't see his wife for 28 years when he was in prison. He didn't want to see his wife. And when she went to see him, she thought he was changed, but she thought it was the prison years that did it. Another impersonation that took place is three ways you can impersonate. You can physically appear like the person. You can simulate their voice, and you can forge handwriting that looks like them. In the case of the voices, even Winston Churchill had a double. And a man, it just came forward, his name is Mr. Shelley, and he said that Norman Shelley, that he impersonated Winston Churchill's voice, that he authentically uttered words by him in the House of Commons during the war, and he helped give the British the energy to go on to fight the Germans, that the House of Commons was not recording or broadcasting directly from their place, but that he was the voice of Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and that he did, in fact, give a famous speech of Winston Churchill's that was very important to the future winning of the war by Great Britain and the United States. I've said all along that the Howard Hughes voice that was given in 1972 was an impersonation, that Hughes had died in 1971, and that they kept him, his empire going up through 1976, the spring of 76, in order to further the tentacles of the satellite, space station, Lockheed, Summa Corporation, the Medical Institute, keep it going as long as they could before they had to cash in the body of the double. So this man, at a time when Great Britain was in war, was the actual voice of Winston Churchill for a famous speech, not all the time, but for a very important famous speech, and we don't know how many. In 1977, that was in August of 77, and in October, tapes 282, 283, and 287, I talked about David Berkowitz with the code name Son of Sam. I've updated it from time to time on other tapes, and last week I talked about the death of Michael Carr. Sam Carr was the man who lived below David Berkowitz, and I believe that that family was involved in those murders in New York City. And John Carr was killed at an army base. They called it a suicide, but with no notice. That was last year. And then last week, the other son of Sam Carr died in a car crash. I have that on tape 410 for those of you who don't have last week's tape. But since last week, there was a front page story, or almost front page, I take it back, page 8, of the Bonnaroo Peninsula Herald, and also in the San Jose Mercury. I didn't see it in any other papers, and I haven't seen it in my New York Times or Washington Post, saying Son of Sam accomplice being investigated. When one son of Sam Carr died, Michael Carr, then they came out and admitted a week later that they're investigating the death of his son, other son, and the Associated Press story this last week said the police in North Dakota say they are investigating the possibility that the man who committed suicide last year at Minot Air Force Base may have helped David Berkowitz commit the murders. The focus is an apparent but suspicious suicide of John Carr, a son of Sam Carr, and a friend of David Berkowitz. Sam Carr was the man to whom Berkowitz referred when he adopted the name Son of Sam during his year-long spree of murder rampage in New York City. I'm reading this from our newspaper out here. The authorities are investigating the connection between David Berkowitz and John Carr since the alleged suicide in 1978. If he was involved in the Son of Sam killings, there would be a reason why he would commit suicide. Now, that's the Associated Press. They don't say if he was involved, he is being killed, so the evidence won't come out. That's like William Sullivan being killed or George de Marenschild at the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations and all these other witnesses. Certainly these courts and these killings of witnesses is identical to Nazi Germany. We could go over them over and over every week. But this article says, new Son of Sam death probe. The UPI said that John Carr fit the description that the witnesses gave of the killer who was responsible for some of the slayings. The Associated Press story out here says that Berkowitz and John Carr were friends and knew each other. The United Press story says that John Carr gives the appearance of the killers that was described. That's why you have to take 8 or 10 papers a day, because one paper says one thing and one says the other, and all of a sudden we find out that the descriptions of the person who did some of the killings was identical to John Carr, the son of Sam Carr, who was indeed the son of Sam, and Berkowitz said he was under his control all along. On the other side, we'll go into some other subjects pertinent to the news, but I think that's terribly important because I have done tapes on this, and I'm always happy when, I'm not happy about it, but when information comes in about Elvis, starting to be drugged on the Army base, or that John Carr and David Berkowitz knew each other, I know that I'm closer to the truth every single day.